Well, I was a man of the house at the age of five in some ways. My mother and father had separated, and I'd do things like I'd run up to the shops with a list of things, and the people would give it to me, and I'd bring it back in my billy cart to do the shopping and things like that. Kids were doing that in those days. It was before helicopter parenting, of course. But my father returned to the family home repeatedly to beat up, humiliate, and rape my mother. There were a few things. I remember him coming in drunk one night and I was sleeping, and he'd kind of loom over me and lift up my eyelids to see if I was awake, things like that, which was a shocking thing for a small child. It really was. And then at one stage, he was beating on my mother, and I hit him with a toy broom and I attacked him, like a little 5-year-old kid attacking a full grown man. And he threw me against a wall, and I was in quite a bit of bruised and in quite a bit of pain for a while. And he told me never to do it again or he'd kill me.
Can you remember as a 5-year-old what you felt about that situation?
Well, it was what I was used to. So in that sense, I didn't know anything but that kind of interaction with my father. It was more that, I've got to do something. It wasn't a sense of helplessness. It wasn't a sense of fear. It was more a sense of anger and determination. And even at that age, I wasn't thinking about consequences. I just knew I had to do something. And that's what I remember of it, is that determination to actually do something to try to make that not happen.
Did you talk to your mum about it? Did you ever have a conversation about what was happening?
I don't recall it. A lot of this stuff is quite vague because it is very many years ago now. But it tended to be, I mean, I know she was very grateful and she was proud of me for doing it. I remember those things as well. But it wasn't really something that we had as a conversation. It was the 1960s. People didn't talk too much about this kind of thing, which is one of the nastier aspects of it. There was nothing like an apprehended violence order or anything like that. The police, if they came around to a domestic violence thing, would kind of steer away from it because they didn't want to get involved in it, because as likely as not, both parties would then have a go at the police. And also, it was a very masculine and macho culture in the police force in New South Wales at the time. And we didn't have any kind of battered wives' homes or anything like that. There was no resources for a woman in that situation, really, in a realistic sense. There was no legal aid.
But what about for you as a 5-year-old? Surely, things happen in your life when you're five. If something frightens you or scares you or causes you anxiety, at five, you generally seek someone out to speak to them about it. Even if it's not your parents, it might be another adult in your life. Was there
Well, I had
anyone
my
to talk
uncles.
to?
I had my uncles, and what they tended to do was act as a distraction. So we'd go and stay with my grandparents' place where my uncles lived in Hammondville in Sydney. And they'd take me out to golf courses and we'd go collect golf balls in the evening. They'd take me to movies. They'd do guy stuff with us and try me and my brother Gary, who was 2 years younger than me. They'd try to show us another world, show us something different from that. And they weren't very educated men. They were very sophisticated guys, but they did care at some level, though guys in those days didn't show much emotion. They did what they could up until the age when my father got custody of both my brother and myself.
So they were, in a sense, trying to protect you from some of those experiences.
They didn't have a go at my father because he was involved with some criminals at the time. And he did have access to firearms, so they were very careful about that kind of thing. It was something which would have been incredibly dangerous to do.
Were you scared?
All the time.
Yet you didn't
Yeah.
really have anyone to talk to about that.
Not for a lot of years, no. But it was one of those things where it was just the way things were. It's a bit like growing up in a war zone in a way. You don't know that there's anything but that. I was about 12 or 13 when I realized, because I went over to a friend's place, I realized that not everybody else's father was like that. I had a friend's father who did something nice for me. And it was a profound shock to me that that would happen.
What happened? What can you remember thinking and feeling when that happened?
Well, first off, that it was something I didn't know happened. I didn't know that there were kind fathers in the world, even though it seems obvious to me now. it wasn't something of which I had experienced at all. And at that stage, I felt like, how come he's got a good father and I didn't? There's a jealousy that sat there for about 10 years in my life, where I was jealous of people who had things differently than I did. And then eventually I came to the realization that even though everything was really horrible in that childhood, even though there were things when I told particularly partners about it, I would have them in tears just by telling them what my life was like. Even all that, it gave me a weird viewpoint, but it also gave me some weird strengths in my life as a person. That I know that I can survive anything except maybe cancer, terminal cancer. Anything that life throws at me, I'm going to find my way through. I may have a rough time of it, but I will work my way through it. And that's the way I've always approached things is, if bad times come along, Winston Churchill said, if you're going through hell, keep going. And that's always been the way I've approached things.
Terry, you said as a five-year-old, you know, you were the man of the house. You were the one who was sticking up for your mum. Your dad was coming around and doing just, I mean, beyond any physical abuse, the lifting of the eyelids is just sounds like such a terrible thing to do to a little kid that you couldn't even fathom. I mean, it sort of speaks to always being in fear that someone's coming and opening your eyes, pulling on your eyelids in the middle of the night. That's a terrible situation for anyone to be in, for a five-year-old to be in. So how is it that you then ended up in the custody of your father?
Some legal things went missing, and he had access to a lawyer and a solicitor where my mother didn't, and there was no legal aid. So basically he had people who were willing to lie for him about his character. He had a whole bunch of criminal associates who had illegal associates who could do things. You've got to remember, all legal documents in the 1960s were on paper. There was nothing on a computer you could back up. If something went missing, it went missing for good. And from what I understand, that's what happened.
And did you say, no, I don't want to go with my dad?
I did. And the thing is that all of this happened while I was 20 kilometres away. All of the court case and the determination by the magistrate or judge or whatever it was, I never got a say in it. I was never stood in front of anybody to say what I wanted.
So how old were you when you moved to live with your dad?
It was 65, so it would have been about almost 8.
So you're still a really little fella. Did things, I can't imagine things got better. What happened when you lived with him?
Well, he moved us out to a farm where he was living. There were two houses on the farm. One was run by a guy who trained racehorses, and we had the other house. It was quite an isolated place. It was very different from where I'd grown up previously. And he managed to isolate us entirely from my mother. There were visitation rights that were supposed to happen. There were weekends when they were supposed to come and see us. My father would arrange for us to go to the beach or go out when they were supposed to turn up. And so for about 12 years, I never saw my mother. Until I was an adult and sought her out myself, I never saw her. They would send Christmas presents for us, and my father would take the cards out of them and put his own cards in and say they were for him. He managed to keep torturing my mother even after he got custody of us by denying her access to us until we were adults.
And did he physically abuse you when you lived with him?
Very much so. I remember being beaten by electrical cords. I remember being punched and kicked. I remember being humiliated and terrified for a lot of my childhood.
Did you try and leave?
Eventually I did, but one of the things he did was he convinced me I was a useless person. There was a lot of that kind of psychological stuff like, you're no good, you're not going to do anything, you're totally useless, you're stupid. I got a lot of that, and that kind of kept me repressed for a long time until as a teenager I started realizing, yeah, I've got a fairly good brain here. And when I was 15, he made me leave school. As soon as I could leave school, he made me leave school and get a job. So I spent from 15 till about 20 working in factories.
Why did he make you leave school? Why did he do that?
He didn't want to have to support me unless I was paying.
Right.
And so I worked in a supermarket for a couple of months, and I started working factory jobs. And then when I was about 20, I realised I didn't really like working in factories. They were noisy and not the sort of people I wanted to hang around with at the time. So I took about 2 years, and in those days it was quite easy to be on the dole. You just put in your form every fortnight and money would come in, and it was just enough to live on. So what I did was I educated myself for 2 years solid, reading anything up to 10 books a week from the library, about anything I could find. Anything that took my interest, I'd read about it. And so by the time I was 20, I'd kind of got myself a good basic education in history and mathematics and weird things like Japanese swords and magic and movies and all sorts of things. And the other thing I did was, when my father got custody, he would go to the pub on Saturdays and then dump us a double feature at the cinemas at lunchtime on Saturdays. So just about every weekend, we were watching two movies in the cinema while he got drunk in the pub.
So some escapism for you. And were you with your brother Gary at the movies?
Yeah, we were. We both saw them at the movies. Yeah, the Regal Cinema in Liverpool, and there were about three pubs nearby. And when my father got banned from one pub, he'd go to the next one and then do it in a circle. But so that was my childhood.
Terry, we so often hear in the context of family violence and domestic violence discussions a cycle appearing, and that's a big issue, because to stop domestic violence and family violence, we talk about needing to break the cycle. Were you ever violent? Did any of what your father did to you, did you take that on board in your own personality?
I was angry and sarcastic for a lot of times, and I pushed people away because of that. And I overheard somebody talking about me once at a party, you know, how that happens. And I wasn't an easy person to know for a lot of my 20s. And somebody said something that really rang with me and changed me in a lot of ways. And sometimes it's just that one thing you hear that can do that in somebody's life. And somebody said, Terry's a nice person, but he's very scared. And that kind of turned it around. I went, they're right, and well, I'm going to have to do something about that. And because I had no moral compass, I didn't know how to interact with human beings in a meaningful way. I didn't know the difference between right and wrong to a lot of ways. I had to learn all this stuff and make it up. There was a stage when I was about 20, maybe a little earlier than that, where my father hit me and I kicked him in the head and broke his nose, his cheekbone, his jaw all in one go. And he then tried to get some of his criminal associates to beat me up. And I walked around the streets for about 2 months with the pocket of my jacket full of pepper, because if anybody attacked me, I was going to throw it in their eyes. And then the other thing I did was, everything he liked, I automatically liked the opposite. He liked plain food. I started ordering the weirdest thing on any menu. So basically, I invented myself with him as a bad example.
Did you ever fear becoming more violent?
When I kicked him, I had a breakdown because I'd been violent. I became like him. He'd won in that sense because he had turned me into a violent person.
Tell me what the psychologist said to you when you started seeing a psychologist.
Well, they said a lot of things. They said, first off, you've got post-traumatic stress disorder. And for me, there are things that trigger me, but I've learned to lessen the impact of them because I understand that I'm being triggered.
What does it mean to have post-traumatic stress disorder for you? How does that actually affect you?
Well, things like, and this hasn't happened in a few years, if I hear a child crying in the supermarket, that stabs me to the core sometimes and I get chills and sweats. If I see, and this doesn't happen as much now, fortunately, but years ago, if a mother or a father was smacking a child for misbehaving, that freaked me out enormously. And there was a stage just soon after Sally and I got together, we've been together 14 years now, we went back to the places where I'd lived as a child with my father, just so I could see what they were like now. And I had a total freak out about it. I started yelling and I just couldn't cope at all. And we went back there about a year and a half ago, after my father died. He died of alcoholic dementia about a decade ago. And I no longer had that reaction. It was because the possibility of him being there that I just found it an unbearable thing to even just be outside a house.
How did you work through all of these issues?
Well, I made a lot of mistakes and I did a lot of silly things. No drug or alcohol abuse or anything like that, but just self-destructive things at a low level. I sabotaged relationships I had. I was stupid and really didn't give myself enough credit for the good things I did. for a lot of years. But eventually that gets a bit tiring and you realise, yeah, what I've got to do is appreciate the good stuff and focus on that. I got some very good psychological help and was never on any medication because I don't tend to like that. But I kind of worked through the issues and found the things I enjoyed. And then along came the internet and podcasting and talking about movies and things like that. And I found that I've got a real joy out of those things. And I just love doing it. I love talking to people about movies and enjoying movies and seeing what's coming up next and discovering old movies and all those kind of things. I found a real passion in that. And that's been a good thing. And also the love of a good woman.
On 105.7 ABC Darwin, 783 ABC Alice Springs, 106.1 FM in Katherine and Tennant Creek. You're hearing from Terry Frost. He's talking to us about something pretty different from what he normally does. He normally talks to us about film. And tonight he's talking to us about his experience of family violence, growing up with a violent father. His dad left when he was little, but he ended up in the custody of his father when he was 8 years old. Terry, notwithstanding wishing that the abuse had never happened, what do you wish had happened in that scenario? When you look back on that little five-year-old, the man of the house stepping in to protect mum, what do you wish had been in place then to protect you?
Well, the things like I went to school with bruises and the teachers could have lost their job if they had talked about it, if they had questioned it or called the police or anything. That's improved since then. Children are much better protected than they were when I was a kid, but they're not protected nearly enough. There are still kids that fall between the cracks. There are still kids whose parents are... And one of the things my father had was he was an incredibly cunning person. He was a bit of a Don Logan in some ways, but he was able to kind of work around things, and if there was a little way to go through where he wouldn't get in trouble or things wouldn't happen, he found that. And one of the things he did, of course, was made sure that he didn't hit me where it showed most of the time. And also the psychological domination of telling me that if I told anybody, I'd be going into a home and that kind of stuff. So basically a lot more resources are put in these days to help children and help women as well. There were just no resources at the time for a woman in my mother's situation.
Terry, I wonder how important you think it is. We particularly at the moment hear a lot of people talking about past abuse that they experienced through the Royal Commission. And the Royal Commission is talking about people's experience of sexual violence in institutions. How important do you think it is for people like yourself who suffered violence, family violence back in the 60s, so many years ago when things were so different, people who may never have told those stories or come to terms with what they suffered, how important do you think it is for people in your situation, not just people who've experienced family violence in the last 5-10 years, how important is it for people of your generation to now talk about it?
I think it's important for one really simple reason. If the resources aren't there, it'll happen to many other people. We need to put money and thought and dedicated people into situations to protect children and women and men as well, but basically protect people who need that protection in our society. It's not something that you can withdraw funds from to look good at the next election or something like that. You really need to fund that because it's basically protecting our civilization in a sense. And you lose if somebody has a breakdown and somebody doesn't function to their full capacity as a human being, then our whole society is diminished by that. And we've really got to help people out. And we've also got to find ways for men not to get in that situation where they may well have an undiagnosed mental illness, which I suspect my father did. We need to find a way to defuse men and to help them not become those kind of human beings.
When you think about your dad now, what are your feelings towards him?
I'm glad he's in the box. I feel that about him. I think that he had mental issues that were never diagnosed and he never sought assistance for because people didn't in those days. I think that he was an incredibly damaged human being whose effects on the world are still being felt these days. They're being felt by people in my family particularly. And that's not a legacy any sane person wants to leave. You don't want to have your legacy in the world to be the shattering of human lives. And if we can stop that from happening, if we stop at the source, if we can stop men from becoming those kind of human beings, then good things will flow from it. If we don't put the resources into that, and we don't put the knowledge, we don't put the research into those things, then this will continue forever.
Terry, it sounds like you took it upon yourself as a very brave and strong young man to decide yourself to become the person that you are today, to not become the person that raised you, to not become your father. It's really wonderful that you've been so generous to tell us your story, to talk about family violence with us, and thank you. You're a wonderful person, Terry. I really appreciate it.
Oh, shucks. Thanks a lot, Liz.